Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Black Software, the Internet and Racial Justice, From the AfroNet to Black Lives Matter, by Charlton D. McElwain, read by Leon Nixon. Introduction. I return refreshed from my long Independence Day weekend, determined to start writing this book. That was Tuesday, July 5th, 2016. I'd cleared a couple of hours in the late afternoon, hoping to produce at least a good page or two. I briefly checked Twitter that morning, on the way to my office. Alton Sterling's name repeated as I scrolled through my feed. In the early morning hours, white police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, had tased, subdued, and then shot Sterling 6 times at point-blank range. The reports that echoed throughout my curated corner on the social media platform said he was unarmed. I did not write any pages that day. It wasn't that I was distraught by the news. Too much other work had simply stormed its way onto my agenda. And, sad to say, police shootings of unarmed black people in the United States had become all too common to be that emotionally debilitating. Just add Sterling's name to the list and wait for the inevitable. This time the inevitable took place the next day. On Wednesday, July 6th, police officers in small-town Falcon Heights, Minnesota, stole the life of another black man. Philando Castile was 32 years old. Like Sterling the day before and so many before, Castile posed no threat to law enforcement. They killed him nonetheless. 4 days later, I finally resolved to put ink to paper, as it were, even if just a line or two. I dropped my 7-year-old son off at his dojo. Then I walked to the Starbucks coffee shop just outside Barclays Center in Brooklyn. I arrived ready to enjoy and take advantage of that kind of Sunday morning quiet that can help you feel delightfully isolated in a city of millions. I wrested my laptop from its case, but before I could even open a new document, people began to steadily stream into the area. I had come to write, but I found myself in the middle of a Black Lives Matter rally. Throngs of people, infants, toddlers, teenagers, and parents filled the square. They carried signs saying things like, "When will black lives really matter?" Drivers laid on their horns, piercing my comfortable silence as they crept through the borough's main artery on Atlantic Avenue. Police sirens soon added to the cacophony. I could not hear the folks leading the gathering, though they spoke valiantly on 2 not quite adequate megaphones. But I knew why they were there. I knew what they wanted. For a moment, my eyes fixated on a black woman walking through the crowd. Her face was pained by much more than an early Sunday morning rise from bed. She carried a sign whose writing was obscured by a larger framed photograph. She carried it close to her, clutched in one hand at the bottom. The sign did not identify the framed young man by name. No doubt, though, he was one of the hundreds of black victims who had died at the hands of police officers in just the first 6 months of 2016 alone. My laptop open, I sat, wishing I could write something about how to change the circumstances that brought this crowd together that day. But better, more courageous folks than I have tried, to no avail, for decades. The crowd soon dispersed and I began to write, placated by the knowledge that, while what I wrote might not change the persistent conditions black people face with the modern criminal justice system, it might help us better understand the latest movement to make that change. Ironically, as I set off to retrieve my son, I spotted a friend, mom to one of my son's classmates. "Oh, were you here for the rally?" she asked. "Not intentionally," I replied, a little happy to see her, a little sad my writing time had ended. When I told her about the book and my grand plans to begin writing it, she started dropping names. "Do you know Farai Chidea?" she asked. "We went to high school together. She's my girl."
"I just talked to her a couple of months ago," I said.
"Omar Wasso?" she asked, recalling a 1990s Vibe music festival where he introduced her to a revolutionary new technology that would help her continue her conversation with an acquaintance she'd just met. The irony wasn't just that I spotted a friend in a crowd of hundreds. It was the fact that this book is both about that rally I stumbled onto and the names my friend recalled. Decades separate each of them, but their stories are inextricably linked. In 2015, two colleagues, Dean Freelon and Meredith Clark, and I set out to better understand how Black Lives Matter emerged. Our report, Beyond the Hashtags, the Online Struggle for Offline Justice, crystallized then NAACP President Cornell Brooks' statement. "This isn't your grandparents' civil rights movement." Our study showed us that Ferguson, Missouri, birthed Black Lives Matter. It told us that Twitter named Michael Brown for the world. Traditional news media outlets were a day late, and when they did arrive, Twitter was their primary source for information. It afforded a 24-hour glimpse into a radical new way of making news, of telling stories, giving unfiltered voice to those whose voices are traditionally unheard, ignored, or silenced. Digital media, social networking platforms, blogging platforms, the open web, user-generated and circulated images, all afforded Ferguson citizens, racial justice activists, organizers, young people, and others a powerful way to counter the Hollywood and newsmaker image machine, one that historically and continuously casts African Americans as criminal, intellectually deficient, and culturally deviant. Trayvon Martin, Renisha McBride, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, Sandra Bland, and many more women and men like them did not become the usual footnotes in the thick annals of black, violent, drug-ridden thugs the American public would easily dismiss. Legions of citizens armed with cell phone cameras and an internet connection shoved a steel pipe through the cogs driving the American image machine. They flooded the web with images that painted the historically most feared, black people and black men more particularly, as sympathetic victims. Online reporting cast them as victims of police bias, violence, and police militarism run amok. News media frame black people as targets of a larger system built and deliberately designed to prey on and disadvantage poor people of color at almost every turn. When we look at today's racial justice movement's success, consider this. Movement participants built dense and diverse networks between affiliated activists, journalists, public officials, and mass groups of anonymous strangers to both hijack and resist media influence and power. They produced and widely distributed compelling, consumable, and usable content across digital space to inform and organize mass audiences. They manipulated algorithms to influence search outcomes. They enhanced public visibility and compelled attention to racial justice causes and actions. They used digital hardware and software to obfuscate state surveillance systems and watch the watchers. They created digital stylistics and protected spaces that produced personal and collective pleasure, instigated conversation and debate, and established community. These compose today's racial justice movement's digital toolkit. Mastering these tools has produced the most visible, sustained, and vociferous movement toward racial justice we've witnessed in the United States since the 1960s. But at the same time, it is both inaccurate and disingenuous to reduce today's movement to those who merely master its digital tools. The people who have widely used and mastered the digital tools that fuel Black Lives Matter and today's broader racial justice movement reflect,
and required a prior technical and political socialization. If this is true, then where did today's digitally revolutionized racial justice movement come from? Who engineered it? What is its signature and what effect has it had on our society? Where will it take us from here? I wanted to answer these questions, so I began to search. I spoke to several prominent Black Lives Matter activists and organizers. I worked my way back through time and landed in the early 1990s when the web was born. I spoke to this person and that one. Many of them turned out to know or know of one another. Their voices and connections took me even further back in time, to the mid-1970s. In that journey through decades past, I encountered a group of people I call the Vanguard. They were Black folks who, from the mid-1970s through the 1990s, used, built, and developed computing technology, digital networks, and online communities that furthered the interests of Black people throughout the African diaspora. Suddenly, my questions changed. I no longer contented myself to find the roots of today's digitally enabled racial justice activism. The fact that I had myself encountered a whole group of people whom our internet, computing, and media histories had never known, much less remembered, led me to ask a more fundamental question. What is and has been Black people's relationship to the internet and computing technology? That's when I discovered a more sobering story. The story should not have been surprising, given America's racist history. Nonetheless, it was a chilling story to resurrect. That story was laid bare in civil rights, computer industry, higher education institutions, and state and federal government archives and periodicals from a bygone era. The story I found there I call Black Software. For me, Black Software conjures the myriad ways that we mobilize computing technology. Black Software refers to the programs we desire and design computers to run. It refers to who designs the program, for what purposes, and what or who becomes its object or data. It refers to how and how well the computer performs the tasks for which it was programmed. In this book, I tell you two Black Software stories. The first unfolds throughout Book One. This is where the Vanguard begins to emerge. They are hobbyists, entrepreneurs, digital organizers, evangelists, activists, and knowledge brokers. The Vanguard positioned Black folks, Black content, and Black culture to occupy the leading edge of the internet's popular social development. Their collective stories begin in the mid-1970s and 1980s and take shape during the advent of personal computing and the early days of personal computer networking. Their story extends through the World Wide Web's birth and the dot-com boom's first bust. Their story demonstrates how Black people have taken technology not originally designed with our concerns in mind. It's about Black people using that technology to further our own personal, communal, and political interests. But Black Software is also a story about how computing technology was built and developed to keep Black America docile and in its place, disproportionately disadvantaged, locked up, and marked for death. This is the story that I unravel in Book Two. It speaks to the nefarious ways those in power use computing technology to destroy Black agency by nullifying Black people's hopes and dreams, aspirations, human potential, and political interests, and limiting the heights we are meant to achieve. This story's shockwaves reverberate and still define our present day. Book Two begins in 1960, when students at MIT and other Boston area colleges briefly aided their Black counterparts in the South who had launched the sit-in movement. This Black Software tale tells a story about American presidents, computing industry corporate titans, and the world's leading science and technology institutions. It is a story about the civil rights revolutionaries who forced white America to its knees, and the computer geeks who ushered in the computer revolution to lift white America back to its feet. It's the story about shadowy figures like those I call the committee men. Black rage flooded America's streets throughout the 1960s. The committee men, at the behest of their government, set America's founding principles of white supremacy loose, to run amok in new computational systems they designed and built. In between these two versions of black software, the kind that positively impacts black people's lives and the kind that destroys them, lies a most significant question, not about recently popularized concepts like computer bias or fair algorithms or platform inequality or digital ethics. No. The question goes to the heart of the matter that these concepts merely skirt around. Will our current or future technological tools ever enable us to outrun white supremacy? After all, this is not just our country's founding principle. It is also the core programming that preceded and animated the birth, development, and first uses of our computational systems. Book 1. Chapter 1. The Great Equalizer. Black America dragged Jim Crow to its deathbed in the 1960s. Still, the nation's elite science and engineering institutions, the ones that were developing the first digital computers, locked black Americans out of their ranks. Educational institutions had not prepared most of these students to enter, and those who were prepared still couldn't get through the door. That began to change by the time Derrick Brown came of age, late in the 1970s. His access to high-quality science and engineering education provided the first opportunity for him and people like him to change their relationship to the computer and the men who once controlled its programming. My first name is Derek. Derek means leader of his people. Ever since I was young, it was taught to me by my parents what my name meant. If I tell you, no, I'm not an activist, I am denying my given name. My role as a leader is as a servant through service. My service to the world is to be the great equalizer. Derrick Brown arrived at Georgia Tech in the fall of 1992. At first sight, the campus community saw neither a leader nor an equalizer. They did not see Derrick as he saw himself. Over the next 2 years, some of them would want Derrick to be something that he was not. Others would push him to do things inconsistent with his nature, with his name. But Derrick would always remain true to himself. Staying true was easy for Derrick to do. As far as he was concerned, he was the same person in 1992 that he was in 1979, when South Carolina's Calhoun Times readers first encountered his name. As long as I can remember, I've been a writer. I love writing. Derrick scribbled words on a paper as early as he knew how. His third-grade teachers taught him how to write an essay. In fifth grade, someone recognized that he was good at it. My favorite activity is baseball. I've played baseball most of my life. It all started on August 23, 1974, my third day in kindergarten. I didn't know the rules of baseball or what a baseball was. I did know how to read well. The next day, we went to the school library. I checked out a book called How to Play Baseball. I took it home, read it for a week, and came back to school all smiles. People always called me Shorty and Pipsqueak, but I didn't mind. That day we played a game. I was the first man up. Usually the first man up is the one who can get on base quickly. I swung all the way around on the first pitch. I was a little disappointed. I waited for the next pitch, and I hit a home run. I was proud of myself and gained more confidence in myself. The next year, I didn't play any baseball. I saved some greenback stamps and got a ball and a bat. A glove was given to me for my birthday. The next year, I played as much baseball as I could. Another year went by, and I ended up in a new school. I had forgotten how to hit. Although I did hit home runs and led in home runs by a sizable margin, baseball became boring. Now, in the fifth grade, I've changed my batting stance to four different positions. This has made baseball more interesting. I'm learning more about baseball every day. I watch baseball every Saturday to learn important plays. That is how baseball became my favorite activity. Derrick continued to hit home runs on the baseball field as he did in writing. His fifth-grade essay won a South Carolina statewide writing contest. He repeated his accomplishment 3 years later, as an eighth grader, in 1982. That time, the newspaper printed more than just his award-winning composition. His essay's subject was valorizing women in the workforce, and South Carolina's lieutenant governor personally conferred Derrick's distinction. In the Calhoun Times photograph that accompanied the essay, Derrick stood alongside another black boy and a younger but much taller white girl who stood beside Nancy Stevenson. Stevenson would become South Carolina's first and only female statewide elected official. As he entered high school, Derrick still churned out essays and other written pieces. He tired, though, of his pen and paper, writing everything out by hand. He pleaded with his mom to find a solution. "Mom, we need a typewriter." "Well, we got a typewriter. Your aunt, she had a typewriter when she was in high school back in the 1970s. Use that." Derrick instantly and eagerly complied. So quickly, in fact, that he'd forgotten something very important. "Mom, I can't type. I don't know how to type." "Well, you should take typing in high school." "Well, no. They have me on this college prep track. I'd love to take an extra math class." "I don't want to take typing." "Take typing." "I don't want to take typing." Dogmatic and determined, Derrick won that battle. His mother, a kindergarten teacher, was not going to argue with her son wanting to take an extra math course. She had another solution already in mind. "I'm about to get a computer. We're going to get an Apple IIe. That's what I'm going to get. And you'll be able to use it because it has a keyboard on it, so you can use it like a typewriter." "Okay." Derrick and his mom traveled 20 miles west on State Highway 301 to Orangeburg to play, as Derrick described, with the computer. He thought to himself as his fingers stroked its keyboard, wondering how he could accomplish typing tasks on a computer without being able to type. "Even if I can't type, I can just look at the keys. The keyboard is nice and soft, not heavy like the typewriter." Mrs. Brown financed the computer. The Apple IIe cost upwards of $2,638. That plus the finance charge would have run her close to $7,000 today. She had some explaining to do with Derrick's dad, but she had already done the deed. As he prepared to enter Calhoun County High School, Derrick wasn't just a two-time composition award winner. He was a member of the first family in town to own a computer. "It was my mom's computer, but I borrowed it. That's when I learned about software. I figured the only way you interact with a computer is through programming, so I start messing around with programming, just like the owner's manual for the computer. I found out that A, I don't understand it, and B, I don't really like it, and B is probably correlated with A. I don't like it because I don't understand it." Frustrated but not deterred, Derrick explained this to his mom. Again, she helped him find a solution to his problem. His mother enlightened him. "You can buy programs to run on this where people have written all these instructions that you're trying to learn how to program. Someone writes all those for you, and you just put the disk in and you use the program." Derrick discovered AppleWorks. Apple had sold the software program at a discount to Apple IIe buyers. His mother didn't tell him how much the software cost, but Derrick was grateful to find out a solution existed. The software bundle included a word processing program. Derrick could have used it to further his writing, but he stumbled upon the database application instead. He had already become familiar with databases in school. He made up his mind then and there that it made more sense to buy software than create it himself. Derrick scrutinized each program as though with a magnifying glass. He learned the secret powers each revealed. After he had created his knowledge base, Derrick reveled in getting the chance to show off his skills, focusing on something he loved, no less. In the summer of 1985, Derek attended the South Carolina Governor's School for Academics. To prepare, each student chose an academic major for the summer school. "I'm going to choose computer science," Derek thought to himself. "I'm going to get to spend the whole summer building databases." He was in for a rude awakening. The first day of class, his professor announced that they would spend the summer writing code in BASIC. BASIC is a computer programming language that stands for Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code. Derek's mind wandered back to that Apple IIe manual and his futile attempts to program his computer, his frustration, and eventual exasperation. Then Derek quietly raised his hand. He spoke softly, confidently, but not enough to appear obstinate or demanding. "Professor, can I, do databases instead?" "Tell you what, you're going to do a project at the end. So for your project, yes, that sounds like a good idea."
"That's great."
"You can do whatever you want to do for your project, but in order to do whatever you want to do for your project, I want you to learn how to write this code." Derek appreciated the professor's flexibility. He did the work, and he was glad he did. In the end, he had learned something new, but that still did not change his mind much about programming. Derek loved writing because it allowed him to bring together words on a page in a rhythmic way. Those words conveyed his ideas. His words could offer inspiration and hope. "When I'm writing code," he thought, "all I'm trying to do is stitch together the algorithm to score a bowling game. That's cool, but it's not the same as writing." Nevertheless, Derek did the work. He learned what he needed, and he got to shine when the final project came around. "Databases were my thing. I like to collect factual pieces of data. I use the database to make an all-star team based on metrics instead of popular booking. I took my baseball abstract by Bill James. I had all the numbers for everybody, and I punched them all in and made those filters to show that my all-star team had to have 30 home runs, 100 RBIs, and a 275 batting average, had to have 350 on-base percentage and 600 slugging percentage. That's how you get on the all-star team. Pitchers had to have a 2.50 ERA. You had to throw at least 200 innings, at least 175 strikeouts." Database applications worked for Derek because he really knew how to exploit them. He also knew baseball like he'd been playing, coaching, and calling games since he walked out of his mother's womb wearing a baseball helmet and with a Louisville Slugger resting on one shoulder. Even without being an expert programmer at 16, he realized that he could bend the database software application to his will. Why? Because he knew exactly what he needed from it, what he wanted to get out of it. He felt in control. By the time Derek had advanced through high school, he had developed a philosophy, parameters that defined his relationship to computers and to software. "I'm a writer. That's my lane. I want to take these tools and make them beautiful and make them do beautiful things. If I can find some beauty, some application, I'm going to grab that because that is what will compel others to engage and use it." The more Derek played baseball, the more he wrote. The more he learned new things, built bigger databases, mastered the magic he saw in numbers, and recognized the value of data, the more Derek got noticed. The next time someone sized up Derek's diminutive frame and recognized massive potential, he was in the 10th grade. Someone was recruiting him, and it wasn't a baseball coach. A Clemson University professor of electrical engineering and computing wanted Derek on his team. At the time, the United States employed 1.3 million engineers. Only a few, more than 35,000, 2%, looked like Derek. Around 1976, Dr. Robert W. Snellsire and his colleague Dr. Sue Lasser had started the Clemson Career Workshop. By 1986, when Snellsire first met Derek, the program that he had spent a decade building was reaching its stride.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?